So, can you tell me your name, your address, your date of birth, please?
Yes, I'm James Noel Davis, J.N. Davis, but I'm known as Jim Davis. And I'm 77 years of age. I was born in 1936, and I...
The date in 1936?
Yes, the 24th of December, hence the Noel. As a Christmas Eve baby, born in Pontypool, then. And indeed, I was born in the address from which I subsequently went to the Stones factory. I was born very near the Stones factory, within a stone's throw, you might say.
Okay, well, I'll ask you about that in a minute, but could you tell me where you live now?
It's off the beaten track. And it's hilly, and it's very beautiful. And I'm actually the chairperson of this complex, and so I'm quite intimately bound up with the complex people and the village people, because about half of the people here have got relatives in the village. So it's quite a good position to know people. And I've also done a number of environmental campaigns here, so I'm almost part of the establishment.
Okay, well, let's go back to your early years. And could you tell me about your family background, your mother, your father, and siblings?
My mother and father were teachers. One taught in the girls' grammar school, my mother, of course, and my father in the boys' grammar school in Pontypool. The college, that's the girls, and Westmont, which is the boys. And they met in the Cymrodorion Society in Pontypool, which was a Welsh speakers society. There wasn't much Welsh in Pontypool except by those immigrants, we might call them, from the Welsh-speaking heartlands. There was no native Welsh in Pontypool left. The last gravestones in Pontypool in the 1880s in Welsh. So everything around me was English. And in fact, in the grammar school, I was known as a Welsh boy simply because they knew I could speak some Welsh.
So tell me where your parents came from then.
My mother came from Kilacum. And that, in fact, is such Welsh as I have, was reinforced every year because that's where we went for holidays. And a very beautiful part of Wales, rather low-lying country, but with the Mathline, the Mynydd Mathline behind, going up to 1,500 feet. But I loved it there. It was a wealthy village, and my father, it was a drover's village in the old days. I think that's what put it on the map. And my grandfather there was the Rhys Creedd, a shoemaker, and my other grandfather, he was a wheelwright, and or rather his... My grandmother, I should say, they were in the local craft people. They did wheels and they did coffins and other woodwork. Not fine woodwork, as other people would say. That was done by another man, Davis D. Capel. He did the really fine jobs and the cabinets. But the next grade was my people. So that's where their mother's from. And we're farmers, and related to, when we go back, related to Morgan Rees, the hymn writer, back to the 17th century, and so on and so forth. And I went there every holiday, so that was a big thing. My interest in the countryside were particularly developed there. My father came from Barry, from the Welsh-speaking community in Barry, so that his Welsh was pretty good. Not as good as my mother's. And he always deferred to my mother. He knew all the grammar because he'd learned the grammar. But he was something of an intellectual. My mother wasn't. But my mother's Welsh was, he always regarded as perfect. And it's interesting because Thomas Jones, the author of Thomas Jones, translated the Mabinogion for the Everyman in 1948, he said that some of the people in our family, Maggie Penstachan, they spoke the best Welsh that he'd heard. Of course, the all the other villagers used to say, what's this nonsense about man? You've been stuck in a bit of bed. Well, but the point was, then in those days, before the, in the 40s, you didn't hear a word of English. So I had a pretty strong background there of Welsh reinforcement. But at home, they stopped speaking when I was four, really speaking to me in Welsh. Mm. My sister, when she was seven, she had much more Welsh and still has, but she's a very good linguist all round, anyhow. So there were two of us. And my mother and father, then they met in the Welsh-speaking group in Pontypool, and they went to, first of all, they lived near the school up in Blindair, in the Long Terrace, but they came down to Ruth Road, which was really quite a posh road, definitely a good address, with people like Wharton Fowler there, who had married Grace Lyle, who indeed was a daughter of Sugar Lyle's, and, you know, brought himself... Well, it was very nice, actually, but he'd been educated in Oxford and had failed, but it didn't matter at all. He had a good time there, you know, and a bit of an interesting... Mother were from up the valley, but, you know, they made... Well, that's the sort of... And teachers galore. Several teachers, two from our school were there, and, well, I can think of four teachers straight away, and then the people who ran the Free Press, who owned the Free Press, they were in the road. Then Miss Roberts, whose brother was a canon, there were the three sisters and a brother was a canon, but none of them got married. They were there, and... Prosser's the builders next door, she spoke Welsh. In fact, I did find out later there were about 10 people in the road who actually could speak Welsh, but we didn't know it at the time.
Right.
We only spoke Welsh with people in Essex. There were no others from the Comradorion on our road, but there were people there, when you dug them out, who did speak Welsh.
Well, let's go on to your education. You said there were lots of teachers in the room. So tell me about your education, primary and secondary.
Yes, I was in primary school, which was just half a mile walk to get there. And my sister went there as well. It was regarded as a very good school. And, you know, there wasn't such a thing as busing in those days, but it's notable that our teacher in the final scholarship year, Mr. Chard, his nephew came from quite some distance to be there. His uncle brought him, but it was because it was a good school. Lots of 11-plus passes, lots of them. And...
So where did you go then for secondary?
Yes, I went to Westmount Grammar School, Jones West Monmouth Grammar School, an ex-public school. It was still, even then, it was in the Haberdashers group. Monmouth School, the boys' school, and Monmouth Girls' School were also Haberdashers, and they remained proper public schools. Whereas our school, while we had a Haberdasher representative there, was much more of a mainstream grammar school. County council run, and I was very lucky because it was pretty slack, and I enjoyed school days immensely. It was really, it wasn't a pushy school at all. We were allowed a gross liberty, really, and that was partly due to Harrison, the headmaster, who'd only got the job, as they said, because he was a Labour man. He was Labour at least until it suited him. And the councillors appointed him, and of course English people were left out of the proceedings. They didn't get a look in. But Harrison was the governor's man, and but he was easygoing.
Right. But you went on from school to college.
I went on then to Cambridge, St. Catherine's College, to read medicine. Now the reason I went there, I was quite a good scholar in school. But things started to break up really when I was in the sixth form. We had some loads of difficulties at home, of all sorts, and principally my father was ill for 10 years, really. I hardly knew him when he was well, if ever, and he got worse and worse. I went up to Cambridge because Bicknell had been there, and in that same college. And Bicknell was his friend, very interesting man, and he taught physics. So up to Cambridge, he said, oh, he's got to go to St. Catherine's if he's going to Cambridge. So actually there I went, but it was a wrong move because I'd also got into Oxford. And that's where I should have gone, because I was going to study medicine in both places. But if I'd gone to Oxford, I would have been introduced to patients in the first week. They didn't do that in Cambridge. You didn't hear about a patient. It was all pure science for the first 3 years. And I wasn't up to it. I wasn't that sharp that I could do well. And I got quite unhappy. And in any case, I only wanted to be a GP so that I could be in the country to study birds and the countryside, which was my great hobby, and had been now for many years, plants and birds. And I sort of was a bit lopsided to go into into medicine just so you could be a GP in the countryside. However, I never had any regrets. It's a very deep root, and I'm still doing countryside work and still greatly value the countryside. But sometimes, just recently, I thought, you know, maybe I would have made a good doctor, and maybe if I'd gone to Oxford, as I wanted to,
yeah,
I would have been a doctor. But I don't mind. It's never seriously worried me. Okay. Anyhow, I was in my first year in Cambridge, and I'd done dreadfully, and I decided to change from medicine to biology, botany, and such studies, geology, and so that was the year, at the end of that year, that I, at the end of my first year, 1955, stop there, I'm just thinking.
So, in the summer holidays at the end of the second year, you said you went to work in
H.G. Stone.
Yeah, could you tell me about...
I went to the Stones because it was I needed some money, and it was just 200 yards from the house. I knew the factory quite well. I knew one or two people who worked there, and I went down and asked them if they'd got any work. Because in those days, there was so much more work about. I mean, I'd already worked in two factories in other school, in school holidays.
Okay, we'll talk about those later on. But, yeah.
So there was work available.
Yes.
So down I went, and they put me, and they said, yes, we do have a job. And they put me in the, I think they call it the patent room.
Could you just tell me, before you go on to that, how old you were and which year it was?
Yes, I went in the summer, then the late summer, that's to say in July, early July of 1956, and I was then 18 and a half years old. That's right. Yes, 18 and a half. And they put me into the patent making room. Now, I should say there weren't many men down there, of course. I reckon there were about 8 or 10 women to every man. And in the patent room there was one man with me. I remember Gordon Denning from Bryn Mawr. Incidentally, people did come from quite a long way to the factories. And the buses, special buses that they had, like Gordon. And our task was to work with the chief designer of the toys. Now, the chief designer, I remember her well, a rather glamorous woman, aged about 40 then, I would think. As far as we knew, not married, because she was known as Miss Biggs. Right, she certainly wasn't Mrs. Biggs, but Miss Biggs. And she designed the toys. And the toys that she designed them in parts, which were later to be each part to be stitched up to make the outside skin of the toy. And so she would have, shall we say, a leg part, and this would be one, and there'd be four of those, shall we say, two, I sort of teddy bear, there'd be two lower limbs and two upper limbs, and then the body and the head. And each of these would have a piece of cloth. Now, how are you going to get that piece of cloth to go to the stitchers? Well, it had to go to us first, to the patent room. The patent room received from Miss Biggs on paper a drawing of the part. Shall we say one leg? It would, of course, be a flat piece. It would be opened up. And there it would be drawn such that when it was then subsequently stitched, it could be got from that part. We then drew that part onto plywood. So the part was now on plywood, drawn out. Then we would put a metal band, we'd tack it down right around the line of the limb. Then we would cut, first of all it would be then it would be cut right out around the metal part, and then a handle would be on the other part. So we'd have now a handle, the plywood, and then the metal piece there. And then that was ready for to go to the stamping girls now. There was mostly men in the fitting room, in the patent room, making the patent. And the girls in the stamping area, they would have whole large pieces of cloth, and they would stamp out on the cloth the part. So it would now be there on the cloth. Then it would go to the cutters, and the cutters would cut the shape out. The shutters, and they would, because the skill for the cutters was not to waste any cloth. I mean, all these are very economic. There was nothing wasted. The place, wherever it was, from Miss Biggs to us to anywhere, you didn't just have, it was all rather well scheduled. And the skilled, such skills as you meant to not waste.
Were the cutters mainly women?
Oh yes, now then. The men were not on the lines in the main. Not in the main. In the main, the lines were women. Now, we didn't, as far as I remember, I was trying to think about this, we didn't have belts. We had tables. So that, shall we say, that the leg part now, shall we say, that it had been cut out, and now it had to go to the stitchers. Well, then the stitchers would have several legs and a body and a head all cut out. They would stitch that up, but that wouldn't be probably one woman. I can't remember, but it was all progressive, so that I would imagine that they would do the legs first, and then I really can't, because I didn't work there, you see. So it was progressive, and it was pushed down the tables so that it was assembled. There was an assembly line, and eventually it would come out, the sewers would have the skin of the whole animal. Then it would be to the stuffers, and the stuffers would stuff it, and then the people would put the eyes and the claws or whatever things, embellishments on the outside, and then the toy was ready. It would then have to go to the inspection people then. We'd have to see that it was up to standard.
Do you remember any of the animals you made?
I don't. It's funny that I can't. The teddy bears, you see, unfortunately, we never handled anything except the plywood. And actually, a piece, an arm cut get out in a single dimension, which that's all I ever saw. So it's something I can't remember. Teddy bears are well known and are very prized. Yes.
Let me ask you about when you went there. Did you have an interview or anything for the job? Do you remember?
No. You know, I don't know whether somebody told me there were some jobs going. It's quite possible, as I say, we knew one or two people. We knew Cecil Smith, for example, the man who did the incinerators, and we knew another man who was... he was on a job from... he was from my chapel, and it's possible that they said that there was work going. I can't tell you. Or just my initiative, I just went down because it was so near. And I certainly was no interview.
Do you know why they were taking extra people on?
There was no shortage of work in those days.
Yeah, but do you know why they were taking extra people
on? Well, it would be the holiday time, wouldn't it? Yeah, almost certainly. Certainly. But that doesn't quite stack up, because they were doing it. I was there for the best part of 6 weeks. Nobody had 6 weeks holiday. But then it might have been... I don't know, so it's no good my trying to guess. All I know is that I had never, when I was in school and then I was in college, getting work in local factories was straightforward. Yeah. Their work was available. And those are good days in that respect, you know. We were just coming on to a post-war boom, just beginning, you know. And it was great, anyhow.
So what were your first impressions, you know, of the factory and the factory floor? And
I loved it there. I never had any difficulties. There were no problems with mixing. Now, I was a completely different social class from most of the girls. Let alone go to college or anything, they'd been to secondary modern school in the great majority. I had no problems. They were all so nice and decent.
You got on with your co-workers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And problems.
How did they take to you?
It must have been mutual. I can't remember a single row. I can't remember an incident. I can't remember anything.
There wasn't any kind of anti-student feel?
No. It's interesting that. I can't remember that. No, I can't.
What about the men as well?
The men tended to be the supervisors, plus one or two of the technicians, you know, the machinery that was there, seeing to all that. Then there was the building group, general repairs. That was there. The man who, Cecil Smith, he did the incinerator. They were quiet and didn't throw their weight about. I can't remember difficult relationships between the men and women at all. As I say, it was, the atmosphere was very good. It was very, very good. I'm sure that was my impression. Of course, I was a young fellow there, and of course there were a lot of young girls, my age group, so there was guaranteed to be some fun there, you know, and that surely, that was the case, you know. And they'd make an excuse to come into the patent room, you know. Sometimes you'd get girls on just saying, well, what's this new fellow like, you know? And it was quite good in that respect. Indeed, I had one or two little flings when I was down there, you know, with the girls. But it was all, everything is, you know, it's good fun.
Was there a lot of teasing going on between the, you know, the men and the women?
A certain amount. But, you know, I can't, I can't remember anything really nasty. I certainly can't remember anything nasty. I can't remember complaints, but I'm sure I didn't. I came away from there, and I was right from the word go, that it's just a very nice place to work at. And it was quite informal, even though they say the Miss Biggs, you know. She'd float in now and again around the factory, and I highly respect for her, no question of that. And indeed, Mr. Stone, the boss man. But it was never a nastiness, no tension there, you know. The drive, you didn't get the feeling that you were being pushed.
Why did Miss Biggs make such an impression on you, do you think?
Well, she was stylish. And she wasn't just me. I mean, all the girls would say that. She wore quite sophisticated clothing, you know, and a hairstyle, and makeup, and in every way. She probably wore scarves and flamboyant things on again. And, you know, she led the fashion, really. Well, like nobody attempted to be a Miss Biggs, one of the girls. By the way, the girls all wore green overalls, which is something I've just remembered.
Right, I was going to ask you about, overalls. Now, did you have to wear overalls as well?
Interesting point. I can't remember. I mean, in the fitting room, the patent room, we call it the patent, where they made the shapes to stamp out the toy cloth in bits. I can't remember. But certainly many of the supervisor men, they wore clothes, they wore some kind of overall or coat, like a laboratory coat, except it wasn't white, it was brown. And they wore brown, as I remember it, you know. But I have a feeling that we didn't have to for some reason or other. But as I say, the girls wore a green coat. That's what you wore.
Now, the work you were doing, did you receive any training for that?
No, I didn't. I think they must somehow have figured that I was going to be able to do it, that I knew my left hand from my right, so to speak. It did require it meant that you had to have a reasonable eye and hand-eye coordination, but nothing more than that. Now, I imagine that, again, had I not been suitable, there wouldn't have been a contract. In other words, if I couldn't do it, then I'm sure I'd have been dismissed or, you know, it would have been quite clear that, you know, I couldn't do it, and, you know, it was holding things up, because again there was a flow. We had to get through a certain amount of this tacking on the stuff, and somebody worked the bandsaw to cut from the plywood the shape, the final thing, but I didn't work the bandsaw. I only did the tacking on of the metal rim of the shape. Yes. So it was certainly unskilled work. I mean, within a week, if you no less, within a week you'd probably get up some pace. Again, there wasn't in that factory that pressure that I'd seen and have seen subsequently in many other factories, whatever job it was. There wasn't that pressure. And I don't think, and I may be wrong again, it was the girls on the lines, I can't recall that there was heads down, hard, hard, hard. Nonetheless, it was still a flow. But compared with what other factories I subsequently visited, they visited a number. Like in Northern Ireland, I remember going to a big shirt factory in Fife, crikey.
So
that was heavy going.
Yeah, you don't think it was piecework, and you weren't aware of time and motion and stuff like that, were you?
That good point. I wasn't aware of it. But this may be, I may have got a rosy view, because we actually had a wall between us, our room, and the main room. Shall we say the main room had perhaps half a dozen lines, you know, which were maybe 20 yards long, 30 yards long, 20 yards long, at the most. I wasn't really aware, therefore, you have to open the door to go there. And they would bring in the cutouts from Miss Biggs. They were the cloths with actually it was paper. They'd bring in the shapes on paper, which we don't know to translate into the shapes onto the plywood.
How about you? Did you have to get through a certain amount of work every
day? No, I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
Let's face it, it was easy going. There was always time for a chat. Always time for a chat. And, of course, our window, the girls used to come in great droves during breaks, lunch and so on, outside us, and we could chat to them outside, and chat we did, you know. And plenty of banter there. It was steady work, and it was real work, but it was not high pressure. And I think this must have been something. I don't know how long girls went. By the way, when I say girls, there tends to be a division between the maturer women and the girls. Many of the women on the lines were women of 40, 50 years of age. Whereas a lot of the girls would be the persons I'd be seeing more of. And they, I don't know where they fitted in, or whether they were just on the lines, or they had special, perhaps, jobs on the lines that weren't quite so demanding. Obviously, one can imagine that the final stitches, getting the whole animal in together, this is going to be something pretty more intricate. They were definitely, whereas if you had all you had to do was sew one single thing to another, it could be quite simple. So I'm sure that there were gradations there of skills and demanding. But I couldn't say any more.
Do you remember how much you were paid every week?
No. No, but again, I never... the thing was, I had a grant going to university. And in those days, a grant was a grant. It was a proper grant. And boys who were careful would have no need to call on anybody else, you know. It would fully cover. And so the money you got in these jobs was pocket money.
Mm.
Of course, if you were from a poorer background, you'd have to give a lot to your home. But, you know, it was adequate, but I'm not going to... I can't comment. It was fine for me. It was really fine for me. But again, I can't remember, for instance, there was certainly no unions involved, or no, nothing like that. When I say involved, they certainly weren't coming round on a regular basis, and I wasn't aware of union presence in the factory. Oh, I don't even know whether there was a union there. This is, again, different to when I worked subsequently in Glasgow, when I was actually a union convener for my little section that I worked. You know, it was quite different altogether there. The unions were very impressing, and they gave us good training, incidentally. We had marvellous training in Glasgow.
Did you have to clock in and out? And do you remember what your hours were? No?
I can't remember. I'm sure we did, but it wasn't... I'm sure we did. I can't remember. I can't.
That's
you know, the whole thing about stones was, I can remember clocking in, for instance, when I worked at Weston's Biscuits. I definitely remember clocking in there. But I can't remember clocking in at Stones. I really can't. And that Stones was a place that seemingly was a relaxed place. I mean, by the you know, everything from the word go, when I went there from the first day to the last, I can't remember a bad moment there. But I may have been, I may have missed a lot.
What about conditions? It was summer, so were you aware of it being hot or noisy?
No, it wasn't very noisy. There were sewing machines, obviously, there. But as I say, I can't remember any moving belts. There may have been one or two in one or two places, but so it didn't have a machinery, a heavy noise. I can't remember any music. Now, this is interesting, because in Weston's Biscuits, the Tannhäuser music was a big thing. For instance, Housewife's Choice in the morning was a crucial piece. And then the thing, and then there would be music also in the day. But Housewife's Choice was a programme on the BBC. 9 o'clock it came on in those days. It would give you an hour, you see. But I can't remember anything, any music at Stones. That, no.
Okay, but right, I was going to ask you, because you, did you, you said you had a couple of flings with the girls, but did you, with a couple of girls, but on the whole, did you regard the women you worked with as friends, you know, did you go out for social evenings with them, that kind of thing?
No, I didn't. I don't know whether they had any, because they weren't friends. There were loads of friends. I mean, there was their social life involved, and the other women, I'm sure. But I can't remember any functions there. No, I can't. No, that's about it. On that score, yes. Yes.
What about in work? Did you regard them as mates, as friends, you know, or were they just...
Yes, I did. I mean, you might say, well, I only lived up the road. Did anybody come up to the house? Well, no, but you could then argue, but I never went up myself once I went down, and I was up for the day. I didn't go back for lunch or anything like that. Again, it's interesting you should say that. I don't think so, but see, I can't even, I was trying to think whether they had a canteen, for example, which I can't recall. I just don't recall it. So it is just possible I went home for lunch, but I don't think so. But... No, the answer to that would be no.
So you don't recall any of the facilities, canteen,
No, it couldn't have been bad, not anything, you know. Toilets or anything, wash places, I can't remember them. I can't remember them. There were a number of disabled people, incidentally, in the factory. We're talking about that, who were on the Green Card scheme, which is a government-sponsored scheme. I'm sure the factory took on a certain proportion of them. My friend in my room was Gordon, and he was a Green Card man. But the epilepsy, or I can't remember what he had, but... It was perfectly all right to do the kind of work he was doing. There were a number of those.
Did you,
the men.
Right. Did you stay doing exactly the same job all the time?
Yes, there? I did. But it got to be remembered, each part was different. So there were lots of parts. So, you know, it wasn't as if you were just bent over and tacking on the rims to the shape, and it was the same shape in the same place. You weren't like that. There are different shapes, different animals, different toys, different shapes. And there wasn't a line system, there wasn't even a belt in our room, just a table, and it was all very, really very civilized. I know it was much, much less hard than the biscuit factory, for example.
Yeah.
That was a tougher assignment altogether.
Mm.
And, yes.
But did you find the work boring or monotonous?
Well, yes, I mean, but there was some... I did, but the opportunity to chat was profound there. It was opportunity to chat. I mean, that's a big thing, because you could be tacking it on, and you put it, and you could chat. We weren't supervised closely. We didn't have a foreperson, a foreman, or four women. If there was a thing as four women, I remember four men, but nobody. We were obviously allowed. It was of course. Somebody like myself would like chatting anyhow. It was a great place. And, of course, again, I'd been brought up with teachers and the like. Well, here was a group of people whose experiences of life were quite different from mine in many respects. And I loved to learn about their way of life, you know, and their being.
Had you maybe... Oh, I know you worked in other factories, but... Before you worked in factories then, had you maybe not come across, and you went to a grammar school, didn't you?
Yes.
So maybe...
The ordinary working class person, no. No. When it's interesting like that. When I went to the grammar school, I think there was a bit of class tension there between me and one or two of the boys who did come from working class backgrounds. I remember that. Now, partly, though, it was also because I was regarded as a teacher's pet, because my father taught there, and he knew all the other teachers, and the other teachers would call me Jim, whereas in a grammar school, people were mainly called Davis or Jones or whatever it was, mainly Davis and Jones. but I would be called Jim by certain teachers. And I remember that did cause a bit of tension. I remember having a fight with one boy, who obviously didn't like me at all. I remember that mostly, though, when I went to the Welsh schoolboys' camp. There was a boy there from a fairly rough area of Cardiff. It was an interesting thing, this Welsh schoolboys' camp. But he immediately called me snob. Well, I was much younger than mine. But that was very interesting. Because your point is perfectly correct, that I hadn't had much association with the ordinary 5/8 working person, although I had by then worked in a couple of factories by the time I'd got down there, and so I was much, much more mature in that respect. I mean, the snob incident, I was only 12 when it occurred, so I was much more aware of my position and more sensitive to different ways of doing things and talking and going about life.
So you obviously enjoyed working the factory for the reasons you've given. Would you like to have stayed there and not gone back to college at the end of that summer?
That was never a serious option. Never a serious option. I mean, nobody said to me, look here, we could, you get on well with people, which is one thing. Obviously, they did see that as, you know, there might be an opportunity if you wanted to stay here and, you know, come train, but nobody ever said that, anything like that. So it never really became an option. But it's interesting at the same time that my uncle had a shop in Blackwood, Jones and Richards, and it was a big shop with about 40 odd staff there, and a very modern shop. And he said to me around about this time, he says, you know, Jim, he said, you know, I think you might like to, there might be an opportunity for you here, because I don't think my daughters are particularly interested in it. But in any case, you could do with a man like yourself to perhaps come and help me and perhaps help take over in the ultimately. What do you think of that? And I laughed it out of court. Now, this was ridiculous, looking back. But again, it shows what sort of attitude I'd got, a very rather peculiar attitude in a way, and then very academically biased, you know, with no real sense of human values at all, I think, then. Yeah, easygoing and that, but I hadn't really added up what the world was about at all. So I turned it down. I said, well, I laughed it out of court almost. I looked back with shame on that, because he'd put his whole life into that. Mm. He'd come from nothing, from a boy who was a shepherd boy with my mother, you know, to he'd become a very substantial and good businessman in Valley. Mm.
But so looking at your work in stones, we're looking at now, you say, did you learn anything about life, society, you know, the world of work?
Oh, I mean, definitely it started to increase my not awareness of what people did, but it didn't. It was other factories, both before and subsequently factories that I visited, especially in Northern Ireland and also in Glasgow, in Nottingham. I visited a number of factories in Nottingham. It was those factories where I saw what I would call slave labour. Now, these were the experiences which were much more profound in that respect. That where I realised, look, there really were two classes of people here, and that this was bad news, you know. I didn't get that in Stones. It wasn't that kind of place.
Oh, sorry.
And I just did the period before Christmas. It wouldn't have started again afterwards. I'm not even sure of this, but I'm pretty sure.
There you go. So you went to work in another factory before you worked at Stone in Pontypool. Could you tell me about that?
Yes. I went to work at Weston's Biscuit Factory. I think it said on it then 6 million eaten every day was their big slogan. You could see it going past on the train. Well, it went up subsequently at least to 10 million. But I think it was 6 million eaten every day then. And they produced a general run of biscuits, and specialities like wagon wheels were there, and export biscuits, of which I'll say a bit more again. A beautiful smell there in the factory. And got that smell early in the morning. We used to come on the factory buses. All these factories had buses going to them from quite long distances away, and Weston's Biscuits, I remember, I had to get up early for me, 6:45, and then out down the road onto the highway and get the bus that come up from Blaenavon Way and go down into Weston's, which was about 1/4 hour, 20 minutes run down from New Inn, where I lived. When we got to the factory, the first thing was it was warm. Lovely. Inside. But I was one of the yard boys. Now, there was a yard gang, and we had a specific job. When the biscuits, empty biscuit tins, as you say, the biscuit tins were, the biscuits went out from the factory in tins, and the empty tins came back. So we had to unload the wagons, and then we had, with a special heavy implement, we had to dib the corners of these tins and then squash them flat. It had an iron foot square, cast iron at the bottom, with an iron pole, and we dibbed the cans and hit them, and then it flattened. And then the flattened cans were the boxes were put back to the scrap for the scrap metal. And it was quite hard work. It was hard work. And there was a supervisor who was a tough egg. There was no messing about here. And we had to, I remember, because I was not particularly strong then, and I appreciated physical strength here, we had to take the empty boxes off. They didn't have the lids on, incidentally. The lids were dealt with elsewhere. So we took four in each hand. We walked up a ramp onto the lorry, and the empty boxes, they faced us, the empty tins, and we had four in each hand, and we walked down with them. And then, after that, we dipped them, and we flattened them. Now, in itself, this could have been done at a leisurely pace, but at the pace that we had to do them, this was not leisurely. This was tough going. And it was the first time I'd ever had to do anything like this in the way of routine work. And routine it was. There wasn't much variation. Fortunately, there was some variation. Perhaps a lorry got stuck somewhere, and we'd actually get to the yard and there'd be nothing to do. Of course, this was marvellous then. And in such times, we had good crack with the boys. For example, I knew one example. There was one boy from Ebbw Vale, a belly rough and ready fellow. He was only about the same age as me, or maybe even a year younger. But he used to say, right then, Jim, he says, let's go for it. I said, what do you mean? He says, I'll show you something. And he took me to the other end of the factory. And we were in a rather special sort of storeroom with boxes, not the usual type of square tins with lids that you commonly associate as a biscuit box even today. These were more like a jerry can and with a round top to them. And he said, right, he said, get your hands into these. And I'd be a bit nervous what he was doing. Anyhow, in his hands would go and pull out these beautiful export biscuits. So we fill our pockets with export biscuits and dashed back quickly. Such was a good break, you know. The other times that we had breaks, we'd sometimes be in the main factory. For whatever reason, we must have had other duties, must have had some other fetch and carry duties. So we'd now come into the lines. Well, then in the lines, there would be quite a number of women workers, of course, and the biscuits would be coming from the ovens and they'd be down the belts and they would be picked off the belts by the women and they would be packed and put away into their tins to go out of the factory. But the thing I remembered mostly about that, especially the smell, there was a beautiful smell in the biscuit factory, outside and inside, was the music. And it was all very quite jolly, especially in the morning. Housewife's Choice was put on. A leading supervisor would be in charge of the records. But Housewife's Choice was a BBC programme. And there'd be sing-alongs. The whole factory would sing. And this would be led by the women. No question about that. So there was a better atmosphere inside than in the outside bit. But it was tough going. There was no doubt that these women were engaged in speed work here, more so than, for instance, in the Stones factory, which I went to and talked about later. The other thing about that factory was a class divide. Not between student workers, one or two like myself, not between us and them, no. The class divide was between the office staff and the people on the factory floor, men or women. There were a lot more women in the office staff, of course, than than men in that case. It was the reverse. There were more women than men on the factory floor. And yes, there was a tendency for them to look down at us, as I mean, assembled workers, and ask them to look down on us, and us to look down on them in defiance, of course. But there was a definite class divide, and some resentment that they didn't have, apparently, have this high-speed pressures put upon them. And it was quite noticeable.
How many women would you say worked at...
Well, so now, we are talking in terms of... I would have thought... I would have a guess and say 200, all told. 150, say.
150 on the
150. Line. That's including office and...
Including office.
Yeah. Maybe... Yeah, I would have a guess at 200 total staff there, but, we've got to be careful. And I can't remember even how many lines there were going at the same time. But, it was big enough, as I say, to have these sing-alongs in the morning and for them to need stimulus from the outside in order to keep going, to keep the pace up. There's no question about that. I knew one person who was, it was interesting, who was a supervisor, in fact a leading supervisor there. I mean, by a very curious coincidence, and we didn't realise it until I'd gone there and met her. But when my mother was small, when my mother had the baby, we had a maid to help us called Dora Tovey. A lovely person. I remember her well because she used to wheel me about in a pram and we used to go and visit her at her house. And Dora had become, not surprisingly, because she was a very, very fine person indeed, she'd become a leading woman. She'd been in charge of the record playing in the morning, at a leading light, women light at Weston's. And so it was very nice to acquaint myself with her and her goings-on. She's a very nice person.
So what was the ratio, do you think, of women to men at Weston's?
Yeah, I would think that it's about probably, very roughly, I would have said... 7-1, 6-1, something like that. Mm. You see, there's more heavy work in Weston's. For example, the dough, and the making of the dough, and the fetch and carry was quite substantial there. Our little gang, the yard gang, was only about, I suppose, 12, 15. And then all the drivers, remember, all the technicians, loads of machinery, loads of upkeep. There wouldn't have been any women engineers or technicians then, doubtful. So the men's presence was greater. And there was, as I say, more edge, there was more drive, and even our own foreman was there was no messing about. You got really told off if you were seen to be slacking. Mm-hmm. And of course, we did slack at the very first opportunity. And I certainly did. And well, we all did. As soon as we had half a chance, we'd be down tools and be doing whatever we could manage to do and scrounge whatever we could. Although, I have to say, the scrounging, that was rather rare, and I was given a special treat by this boy from Ebervale. I think he felt I needed a treat.
So how did the work compare? I know you were a different, such a different age there, 4 years.
Well, I was
different.
2 years younger then, wasn't I? Yeah, 3 years younger.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. No, it was more than that, isn't it? Yes.
3 or 4 years, anyway.
Yes.
So how do the work compare? How do the factories compare, do you think? Conditions
and
stuff
like that? I would have thought I just thought that there was nothing like stones. That would be my impression. But that, on the other hand, looking back now, this remarkable woman, Dora Tovey, who'd got this position, they was obviously, they knew who was good. They got a genuinely good person. So there weren't stupid people about here. There was awareness. And there must have been some sensitivity. And I would have thought that it was harder because it was faster. That was the chief difference. And there was this class divide which you didn't have at Stones. So that if you're on the line in West Ends, you'd be here on the line. You're definitely not, you wouldn't have a sense of self-esteem, which I think at Stones you probably could have maintained. You would have been much more a cog down there.
You worked in two or three factories when you were younger then, and for like short space. Can you evaluate what those experiences meant to you?
Yes, I worked at Pilkington's Glassworks in Pontypool on a similar holiday job, and I was a yard boy there again. The supervisors there were relatively easygoing, but the work was hard and monotonous. There's no question. It did, but the foreman made the difference. The foreman we had in Pilkington's, although the work was physically nearly as hard as at Weston's, it was easier going. The experiences I had were great down there. There weren't many women, far less women, but there were women in the glass cutting operations. It's a very dangerous job. There's a lot of dangerous work in Pilkington's. But we didn't come across women there at all. But again, I would say that in Pilkington's, there wasn't a bad atmosphere. You didn't get the impression that this was slave driving, although undoubtedly there was. I've got to be very careful because I wasn't in the glass cutting. I mean, the glass had to be made, it had to be liquefied, and then it had to be brought in great curtains and cut into great panes. Then the panes were further cut down into individual orders to go out in various sizes. There's a lot of cutting, a lot of dangerous work there, accidents there. They had a doctor, because I knew that, because our home doctor was the doctor, and she would be there regularly supervising and treating wounds and the like, and seeing that the health and safety was up. There was also security at the gate, interestingly, which I don't remember at anywhere else. There was security at the gate at Pilkington's, and it was the branch of the Pilkington's of St. Helens, you know, a very big firm indeed. And that finished. Whereas Weston's Biscuits, interesting, you're still going. Mm. Still going.
Yes.
So, for
so
me...
Just really, how did these experiences affect your... Did they have an effect?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Oh, absolutely.
And what kind of learning curve was
yes,
it for
Yes, all sorts. I appreciated what hard, monotonous work was like. I appreciated what it was like to be at the bottom of the pile. I appreciated the sheer effort of getting to work, doing physical work, was, and this was considerable, even at the reduced pace that us youngsters, you know, had, because we weren't expected to be doing at full pace. Then I remember the learning about people who had a completely different background to my life and a way of being and a way of talking, a way of doing, a certain frankness and openness which I admired, a certain freshness. I met it, of course, in the Stones factory. It was among the girls. I had contact with the girls which I had not had before, and it was a freedom of expression and a directness, all of which I found very valuable. So I from even these three experiences, I broadened my understanding of human life as it was in the Eastern Valley considerably, and that stood me in good stead the rest of my life.
Good.